succession number 23147, reel 3.
Norman Dorr, reel 3. So we've come to where now? You know where
we were at Vernon.
Right, that's right. So you crossed the Seine on what sort of a bridge was that? Do you remember?
They made a Bailey Bridge across. You know, I've got some photographs of it, and we've been back to visit since. Because we went across into Vernonnet, that's the village on the other side of the town, on the other side of the river from Vernon, and we were then drawn out of the front line, and so we stayed there for about 3 days. And I was stayed with the family, and had a son named Michael who, ever such a nice young man, and I kept in touch with him afterwards and wrote letters to him, and I've still got some of his letters and photographs of him standing beside. I took one photograph of him standing beside the Bailey Bridge, and
what was the attitude of the civilians to you lot arriving?
Ever so friendly. Really? Yeah, they were there for a non.
Were they so relieved that the Germans had been pushed back?
Yes, they had. Of course, they hadn't seen a great deal of the fighting, and I suppose they went through there rather rapidly, and not a lot of damage was done. Mm. And the people, the Vernonnet people, were very nice people. Mm. And I went back in 1982 on a caravan tour, and we went to Vernon and Vernonnet, and I tried to find Michael. I remember we went to the cemetery there and talking to a lot of people, and asked them about this family Lamaterre, and I went to a butcher shop, and there was a nice lady there. She said, "I know Michael Lamaterre. She lives up in the forest." She said, "Have you got a car?" So she said, "Come get your car and then follow me." And she took me to Michael's house, and we met his wife and mother, and they just had a granddaughter, and it was lovely to meet them all over again, you know.
Yeah. So did you stay in Vernonnet long?
No, about 3 days, I think, we were there afterwards.
Yeah. So a bit of a rest, was that?
Yes, right, a rest out of the front line. Yeah.
So what did you feel, the fact, I mean, now you crossed the Seine, that would have been one of the big obstacles, haven't you?
Oh, yes, it was one of the start of it, anyway, yeah.
Did you feel the Germans were on the run now?
Not quite at that stage, I don't think, no. Mm. It was still pretty heavy fighting. Yeah.
Okay.
Down in the next place, what was it, when they did the approach to the Arnhem, you know, going up through into that, what they call it, the village. We went through. Eindhoven was the first place.
Right. So what did you know about Operation Market Garden? Had you any idea before it happened that there was going to be a big do?
Yeah, we knew that the airborne were coming in. Well, we saw them coming in, you know, and by the thousands,
what sort of
flying
a sight
over.
Was that?
Pardon?
What sort of a sight was that?
Oh, great! Yeah, we felt, you know, we thought, well, we're not on our own after all. All these planes coming and drop these people. Mm.
Yeah. So, did you think this was going to be a decisive?
Yeah, we thought that having been planned well, that it would be a clean run straight through to Arnhem and the bridge, you know, and once we got over the river Arnhem, the Alst, we thought, well, you know, the end of the war's in sight now, but it didn't quite turn out like that, did it?
So when did you first get an idea that things weren't going very well?
Well, when we were at Nijmegen, and it was pretty fierce fighting there, and of course they were counter-attack, and then they had plenty of their planes.
By the bridge, was it?
By the bridge.
Right.
Actually, I dug in under the bridge.
Did you?
Mm.
With your carrier?
With the carrier beside me, yeah.
Right. So it was a steep bank to the bridge?
It wasn't a very steep bank.
Right.
And I dug in underneath, right underneath the bridge. And I got my head down, I remember. And I felt something on my face. And it was red. And there was a German on the bridge who'd been shot. And he was bleeding through and dropping on my head, which I didn't like very much. I always remembered that, with a feeling of horror.
So was that you and the whole carrier crew?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So you were underneath, and you were poised to do what?
To go forward towards Arnhem.
Excuse me. Right. Mm-hmm. So how long were you there under the bridge?
Well, 2 or 3 days, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what were living conditions like? I mean, you had dry rations, did you?
Yeah, they brought up rations whenever they could, you know, but quite often you went without for couple of days. And we used to have what we called 14-man packs on there, which had plenty of fags on there, which was one of the big things. These round tins of 50 cigarettes, you know, which encouraged you to smoke even more. And being with the old man, the colonel, I wasn't there short of a 14-man pack, you know. Right. I did pretty well, I suppose, yeah. Really.
So you were the colonel, driving the colonel?
All the time, right, yeah. Right through.
His name was, just remind us.
Yeah, I drove the colonel right from Hill 112 right through to the end of the war at Berlin.
Right, so and his name was, just to remind us?
The first one was Colonel Venner, yeah. Colonel Code, Bill Code.
Right, yeah.
Then Colonel Venner,
right.
And then my hero, Speedy Breeden, he came on afterwards, when we crossed the Rhine.
Right, so at Nijmegen, this was Colonel...
At Nijmegen, it was still Colonel Code,
right.
Bill Code.
Okay,
yeah.
So what was he doing? What did you hear about what was going on? Because with being with the colonel, you'd hear some bits and pieces.
Oh yes, he knew the score all the time, you know, but he wasn't a very sort of communicative, not as far as his lonely driver was concerned, I suppose, you know. I mean, he was a very nice man and all that. He treated me well, but I suppose he confided me on the war secrets.
Right,
so,
yeah. But I wondered, I mean, you would get an impression from his mood and...
Oh, yeah, how things were going.
Things were going, so...
Yeah.
I suppose you were getting a lot of rather disappointing sort of feel about it.
Well, no, I don't think he would ever show any feeling like that.
Really?
Colonel Code, he was quite a tough guy, no doubt.
Yeah.
Anyway, we moved on up. We didn't actually do the fighting at Nijmegen. But we moved on up through then to a village of Driel, which is on the south bank of the Elst, quite near Arnhem. We could see Arnhem Bridge from where we were, you know.
Yeah. What was going on at Arnhem Bridge? Could you see all?
You could hear the fighting, and of course artillery was firing all the time. Mm. And there was a lot of shooting across the river there. Mm. And as we pulled in, it was very misty. And we pulled into the village of Driel and dug in. And my gunner at that stage was Charlie Portsmouth. I remember Charlie sort of got out of the trench and stood on the edge of the trench and suddenly come tumbling down into the trench. And he said, I've been shot. And he just got nicked by a nearly spent bullet and it scored his thigh. And we had to dress him and he was bleeding a bit, you know, poor Charlie. That took the wind out of him a bit. And of course the Jerrys could shoot right across that river because it wasn't all that particularly wide at that stage. And the 4th Dorsets had gone over the river and they were trying to rescue the airborne that had dropped there. And of course the airborne had dropped too far out of the area to it ruined it as far as they were concerned because they didn't drop on their target and they were too far out. And
did
those
you see the 4th Dorsets going across the river?
No, we didn't. I didn't see them going across, but we did see them when they came back across, absolutely, and bringing some of the airborne back, and they were a bit draggled, and some of them, I don't know why, but they were wearing all sorts of different clothes. They seemed to have got rid of a lot of their clothes, and they were wearing anything they could get their hands on, you know. And our people were helping them back through our lines, good to go on back down to Nijmegen. And
were a lot of them injured?
Well, I didn't see a lot of injured, but apparently they were quite a lot injured.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But those I saw were walking, but very weary, war weary, sort of battered and straggling, and looked in a terrible shape, you know.
Did you have a sense at the time that things had got stuck and things had gone badly wrong and could go either way from here?
Well, we thought that was a real faux pas there, that they hadn't worked that out quite according to plan, and things had gone badly wrong at Arnhem, that they lost so many people. Of course, the 4th Dorsets lost quite a few men there, you know.
Yeah.
One of my mates that I regularly go to our meetings with now, he went over that river about 9 different times to help people back across. Yeah.
Goodness me.
Yeah.
Goodness me. What was his name?
Bob Rigler. It was... Sergeant Major Rigler.
Right. I haven't got him on the list.
Oh, I got a photograph of him.
Yeah. I wonder if he'd do one of these tapes for us, do you think?
Bob, I don't know, I expect so.
Yeah, yeah. wonder if he'd be kind enough to give me his phone number now, if I could ask him.
Yes, sure, you can ring from here.
Yeah, well, not at the moment.
No,
no. You know, if I take the number, that would be good.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure Bob would be only too pleased to help, because he's a real army man, loves it.
Right.
He was a sergeant major in the Pioneer Platoon.
Yeah.
And when the war was over, he stayed over there doing a sort of a civilian job.
Right. Okay, well, I'll ask you for that number later. So back to Arnhem then.
Yeah.
So you were there by the Nijmegen Bridge.
Yeah, in the village of Drill.
Yeah.
That was near Arnhem for some days.
Mm.
And then we moved on down the river, and I know we crossed at a place called Rees, RWS,
mm-hmm.
where there's quite a cemetery now. And the Black Watch had gone in and attacked the village of Rees and lost a lot of men, because I know I was driving my brand gun car out the road, and there were still the bodies of the Black Watch lying in the road that hadn't been picked up, you know.
Yeah.
They had a pretty rough time going through there, the Black Watch.
Mm. What did you think about the different regiments? Did you have sort of opinions, you know, group opinions about who was really good and who wasn't, or, you know?
No, none at all, really. Yeah. I mean, everybody was good as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
We were beside the Scots regiments quite a few times, you know, over there.
Mm. Did you ever used to get a chance to sort of chat to them, or?
Not really,
or
no.
Separate, I suppose.
I did have a chat to the Americans on one occasion. I believe that was before Falaise, so we went to visit the Americans. Our colonel went to have a conference with them.
Yeah.
And they'd never seen a Bren Gun car before, and they all gathered round and were, you know, talking quite excitedly, and helped us out with a few K rations, which we were only too happy to have, because their rations were far superior to ours, apparently.
Yeah. They were very friendly to you.
Oh, the Americans were, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of them as fighting men?
Well, my opinion of their fighting ability wasn't very high, but I mean, that might be doing them an injustice, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, had you by this time used your flamethrowers on your...
No, we didn't have any flamethrowers over there at all.
You didn't take any over?
No, we didn't have any in France at all, no.
Do you wish you had them?
I don't know. You had got to get very close to the Germans to use those, haven't you? I didn't want to be that close. But no, we didn't have any over there.
Mm. Yes, it always struck me they'd be more used for an invading force than for a...
Yeah. They had Shermans, of course, over there with flamethrowers on them, but no brain gun cars that I knew over there at all.
Yeah, right. So... You stayed around Drill, was it, for a long time? Or?
No, we were on at Drill for a few days, and then we moved on down the river, and then we went over at this town of Rees.
Yes, yeah.
And then what happened? Colonel Venner joined... After Drill, Colonel Venner took over on the 26th of September 1944, I got here, and... Colonel Code then became brigadier of our brigade.
Right.
So he was promoted, and Colonel Venner took over.
Uh-huh. So was he different to work for, Colonel Venner?
I don't think he was such an experienced or such an old soldier as Colonel Code was. You know, he was a real dyed-in-the-wool soldier.
Mm.
But Colonel Venner was an extremely nice man, quite a gentleman compared to a lot of people, you know.
Did he treat you well?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'd never had any complaints from any of them. The colonel always treated me with greatest courtesy and respect, you know.
Yeah.
Got on with them ever so well.
Yeah, because I suppose they were quite reliant on you, and also they probably spent quite a lot of time with you, didn't they?
Oh, hours, yeah. When
you weren't exactly a pal, but, you know, you were still quite a close colleague,
Yes, we were, yeah. Mm. We were close to one another quite a lot, you know, and we used to share our food and... That sort of thing.
Right. So was the rank not such a big thing once you were in battle?
I don't know. There was always a discipline and a respect there, you know. You always said sir and saluted them and did the right thing. But but there was a friendly atmosphere with it.
Right. So your first engagement then with your new colonel would be where?
Well, I don't remember these places. Heligran, Grosbeek, Dorset Wood, that was one of the next ones, which was a terrible, terrible time.
Mm.
course of wood. We were up to our eyes in mud. It's been raining and raining, you know. And the bringing cars couldn't go everywhere. They brought up what they call the weasels. They were something like a bringing car, but they had great wide tracks,
yeah,
so they could go through this very bad weather. But the fourth Dorset and us were together in Dorset Wood, and it was a real bloodbath there, and that's why they called it Dorset Wood afterwards, because the regiment lost so many people there.
So where were you at the beginning of the action in Dorset Wood? Do you remember what sort of position you were in? Or?
Well, I went with the forward troops with into Dorset Wood, and I can remember seeing a Sherman tank, and it was firing blindly at the Jerries, because there were Germans all over the place hidden in the wood, you know. And I can remember some Germans coming out with their hands up, comrades, you know, surrendering. And the Sherman machine gunner gave him a burst of machine gun fire. He was like all of us, I suppose, our blood was up, and he didn't give him much chance to surrender. And one of the Sherman officers was sitting up with his in the top of the tank, and a shell took his head off. That was another terrible thing that happened in Dorset Wood.
Yeah.
But, it was a real bloodbath, that, you know. We lost a heck of a lot there.
Could it have been done differently?
I don't think there was any way you could have done it much differently than that. I mean, obviously a wood is a good place to conceal yourself, and a good place to defend yourself, and they certainly did that.
Because the 5th Dorset seemed to have done a lot of this attacking in places where it's going to cost a lot of men's lives,
yeah,
to achieve the object.
Yeah, but obviously that was a place that Germans were going to defend, wasn't it? You know, it's a place that was naturally defendable. Yeah, the 5th Dorset took over from the 4th there, because one of my friends that goes to our meetings, that was the only time during the whole war his relation, his cousin I think it was in the 4th, and he was in the 5th. That was the one time they met one another when they were changed over trenches in where we went into Dorset Wood, you know.
Yeah. So how long did the action at Dorset Wood take?
I haven't got any record of that either. I know we were in this mud for some time, and they had a job to bring up food rations to us, you know, because of the mud made travelling very difficult. I know I had problems getting my brain gun cars through the mud, you know. It did get through.
Right. So when you pulled back from there, did you get any sort of rest, because you'd had...
Oh, yeah. We used to do a few days in action, and then we would get a few days, you know, make up ammunition and clean up things and get your clothes clean and so on. Trips Rath, Guy Linkirk, and that. I'm afraid the names of these places don't mean a lot. I know Gok and Cleve were places where they had a tremendous artillery battles, and the towns were absolutely razed to the ground. I've never seen two towns like it, Cleve and Gok. They were completely flattened and wrecked. They're awful.
Did you see that happen? Or?
No, we came into it after, and they saw this terrible wreckage all over the place, you know. Cool. And then Colonel Breeden, he came and joined us. He took over on the 1st of March in 1945.
Really?
And yeah. Colonel Breeden was my hero.
Really?
Yeah.
What had happened to Venner?
He came back to the War Office. I don't know happened. There was some little... Pardon?
Any particular reason or problem? Or?
Well, I believe there was, but I don't think I ought to say.
Even though he's long gone now?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So we'll have to look it up then. But he was pulled out of that job.
Yes, he was, and Colonel Breeden took over.
Did you get any warning of that, or... Did you realise anything might have been causing a problem?
No. No.
Just suddenly happened.
Yes.
Did he explain to you what had happened, or did he just...
No.
Right, so you sort of picked up...
I presumed,
Okay, so you then got Colonel Breeden.
Colonel Breeden, yeah.
Right, so what sort of a chap was he?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, smart as paint. Brilliant. He was my hero. I always felt that he was a real perfect soldier and a perfect gentleman and everything you could wish for. You know.
What sort of age was he?
I got a lot of information about him, a lot of letters I wrote to him after. Mm. Good bit older than me, of course. Mm. But he's dead now. He was, I suppose, 45, 50, something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So quite a senior man.
Oh, yes.
For those places.
He'd been with the Gurkhas, and he was a colonel with the Gurkhas, I understand. And and his relations have been with the Gurkhas since. But when he came to us, he'd been with the first Dorsets, and he wrote a book of his own called The Three Landings. He did landings in Sicily and Italy, and then Normandy, and the first Dorsets, of course, landed on D-Day with the first Hampshires in Normandy, and a marvellous record they've got.
Yes.
And of course he took over the first Dorsets in France, became the commanding officer, and then when they came back to England, he took over the fifth Dorsets on the 1st of March.
So did you know anything of his army career?
I didn't then, no. Since found out all about him.
Met him fresh, as it were.
Yeah.
So what was your first action with him then, Colonel Breeden?
Milligan. Oh, that he was with us when we went into Rees, that's right. We've got Speldrop, Landfort, Anholt, Enschede. No, Hengelo was the... with the Hampshires and the Dorsets, we captured Hengelo. We go back to Hengelo now. I don't know whether we're twin with them or something. We go back to Hengelo now. We've been back umpteen times to meet the people of Hengelo, and they came over here last year.
So what do you remember of the happenings at Hengelo?
Well, it wasn't very fierce all gone through there, except that there was one concealed gun that knocked out one of our vehicles and killed three of our blokes, and they were buried quite close to Hengelo. I've seen their graves over there, but that wasn't all that fierce fighting in Hengelo, but the people of Hengelo were so delighted and overwhelmed, you know, that we've taken to them and they've taken to us, and we've sort of got a marvellous rapport with the Hengelo people, so that was one of the better battles, I think, you know, the easier ones anyway.
So did you get used to your new colonel quite quickly?
Oh yeah, Colonel Breeden,
slightly
yeah.
different to work for.
Yeah, he was marvellous.
Braver
so man. I've never
was he marvellous? Tell me.
Well, he was such a brave man, you know, and everybody else would be cowering down behind whatever cover they could find or behind walls, and he'd be there standing, although he was fireproof and bulletproof, and you'd think, well, he must be mad, but he came through it, so, you know.
He never got hit?
Never got hit, no.
Really?
No.
Because I've heard about these officers who stand up bravely
and
they get their heads blown off.
Yeah, you know. Not him, no. Right. Marvellous man.
Has he calculated where he was going to stand up?
Well, I don't know. It didn't seem to, though.
No, really. Yeah. Can you tell me about one incident when you saw him, you know, braving it out?
Well, I can't remember where it was, but I can remember I was carrying down behind this wall, and there was Speedy standing out there as though he was out for a birthday treat, you know. Marvellous man.
Right. And that really inspired you and other people?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you couldn't run away if you had a man like him leading you, you know.
Did you ever feel tempted to run away?
I ever did, no.
Did you ever see anyone else not being able to cope with it? Because, I mean, you've been under huge strain.
I saw a few blokes go a bit bomb happy, but nobody that sort of turned tail and ran or anything like that, you know.
What would happen if someone went bomb happy?
Well, they'd lose their nerve, I suppose, completely, and start babbling and showing a great deal of fear.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I saw one or two of those in Normandy.
Yeah. And what was done with them?
Oh, they were shipped out as soon as anybody realised that they were... I mean, I suppose that during the war that they began to realise that it was an illness rather than lack of guts, you know. Mm. Mm.
So you had a fairly easy push through. Sorry, I forgot the name of the village.
Henglow.
Henglow, that's
yeah.
right, yeah.
Yeah, and then Kloppenburg, Tarmstedt. I forget where it was now that they used what they called what's the name of their Sherman tank with no gun or turret on the top, and they used to transport the troops forward when they were under small arms fire to give them crocodiles. Yeah. Yes, crocodile. And I remember on this particular day that we were going forward, and it was towards the end of the war, and the Germans were more or less on the run, but fighting a very strong retreating battle, you know. And this road that we went along, I went along it was speedy in the morning on a recce to see what the forward thing looked like. And we came back along this road, and the crocodile started to go through loaded with troops, and one of these went over a mine. The Germans had started putting these sea mines underneath the road with what they call trembler fuses, and the first vehicle or first few vehicles went over started the trembler fuse going, and the next one that came along, of course, it was live and up it would go, and one of these crocodiles came along and blew the whole lot sky high. And I'm feel sure it was the one that I'd taken a photograph of just as it was starting to go down this road. And of course, all my mates were on it. There was a section of nine in A Company, and one of my special mates was the corporal in charge, and he was killed with all nine of them, you know.
Before your eyes.
And not long ago, there was a bit on the teletext asking if anybody knew about this man named Ford and anything about him. Of course, I saw it, and my mate at Parkson had already written to someone about this same incident, and so I was able to take the photograph out of here.
Yeah. And so you had a camera with you?
Oh yeah, I took a lot of photographs during the war.
Right. And you weren't meant to, were you?
Oh yeah, nobody.
Were you in no problem.
No,
right?
The colonel didn't mind. I took some of him. Different time.
Got more
here. and I took this picture of this crocodile as it was going forward, and I'm sure it was one of the A companies, but I couldn't be 100% sure that it was the one that got blown up.
Right. But it was that bit of road and that moment.
And I wrote a letter to this man Ford and sent this blown up photograph of this carrier, and he wrote me back such a lovely letter thanking me for it. And his mother had been worried sick because she wanted to be certain and sure that her son wasn't captured or a prisoner of war or anything, and she wanted to know that he really was killed and
quickly.
Yeah.
And, she certainly was. Yeah. And you could actually show her where it happened.
Yeah, tell her all about it.
Yeah.
And that gave her a lot of peace of mind, so I understand.
Because that was a particularly demoralising incident, wasn't it? A whole crocodile full of.
Yeah, a whole nine, yeah. The crocodile was blown 150 yards into the field because it was more or less like a road going through an island. It was all marshy land, so you couldn't bypass it. So every hole that was blown, and some of them were as much as 90 feet across, they had to be bridged and before the next lot could go across, you know.
So although the Germans were retreating, they were
slowing us up by doing
order,
that.
Yeah, because they were leaving all that behind for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I believe there was nine of these mines in a distance of about a sort of a mile and a half, something like that.
Yeah. They were quite thorough, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Right. Norman Dorr, end of reel 3.